So this morning, everybody has the materials, second lesson, which we gave out this morning. No, you were not here this morning. Or you were on the internet. Okay, good. So do we have the second lesson there? Not the third one, second one. So those who did not get the second lesson, please give them the second lesson, but not the third one, only second one. Yes, everybody has? Yeah? Okay. So this morning we started introducing, lesson number two. False ego is so dear to us, so therefore we are always defending and protecting the false ego. And we were introducing the first principle of Vaishnava etiquette. A devotee should never defend himself or herself. The only exceptional situation is when one of the six aggressors is attacking. We were mentioning them this morning. I don't want to mention them again. And we were saying this doesn't happen every day. This is a very exceptional emergency situation. Then we are allowed to defend. But what we do is that we defend verbally, right? We answer back. We want to have the last word. We want to prove that we are right after all, that we knew anyway already, and. So in Vaishnava etiquette is that a devotee should not defend himself. We should defend other people. Oh, I'm just remembering. I forgot my verse book. Can somebody maybe go? Yeah, because I was on a Skype conference for 2 hours and just 10 minutes before 5 I closed this. And can you go in my room and you find my computer back there somewhere, and there is some red verse book, my red book in there, yes. So we were saying, a devotee should defend other devotees but not himself. And if we actually follow that etiquette, then even if we are unfairly treated, then surely some devotee should step forward and defend us, right? So that we don't have to defend ourselves. That's actually the etiquette. And we were saying, especially towards seniors, it's so uncultured and inappropriate to answer back and try to be right and. Even if we are unfairly treated, as a devotee, we should see it as a wonderful opportunity to let go of this ego satisfaction, this ego demanding to establish that we were right after all, and actually it didn't even happen like this, and. So even if unfairly we are accused of something or not treated properly, that one exactly. So then we should just say, okay, this time I was in the right, but thank you. But so many other times I was wrong, so, it's Krishna's arrangement that I am, even punished, for something that I didn't do or something. Well, it's okay, no problem. Let me tolerate. And this quality of tolerance is such an important quality to develop in spiritual life. Actually, tolerance is the criteria to measure a devotee's spiritual strength and advancement, is in how much a person can tolerate. And the classic examples is Haridas Thakur, Prahlad Maharaj, tolerating so much, never avenging themselves, but simply tolerating. And tolerance means we can only be tolerant if the false ego is subdued and dissolved. Because what makes it hard to tolerate is the false ego rebelling and protesting and but that's exactly the ego. You know, so a person who can tolerate and doesn't get agitated, even in the most provocative situations, it means his ego or her ego is subdued, is dissolved. Otherwise, tolerance impossible. I have collected a few nice quotes. You have the numbers here on your materials, but I didn't put the quotes there. Some nice quotes in regards to tolerance. 1848. It says there, the devotees of the Lord are so forbearing that even though they are defamed, cheated, cursed, disturbed, neglected, or even killed, they are never inclined to avenge themselves. That's the Vaishnava mood. You know? That even though we may be neglected, cursed, disturbed, defamed, cheated, so many things. Devotee, that's the Vaishnava quality, that a Vaishnava doesn't, you know, have that urge to avenge, to take revenge. Oh, I'm going to show that person. You know, that's exactly the ego. You know? Yeah, so that's the Vaishnava mood, actually. There's another nice one. 4:19:34. Listen carefully. The verse is like this. We should always remember that if something happens by providential arrangement, we should not be very sorry. The more we try to rectify such reversals, the more we enter into the darkest region of materialistic thought. So now Prabhupada gives a nice purport. Sometimes the saintly or very religious person also has to meet with reversals in life. Such incidents should be taken as providential. Providence, Krishna's arrangement. Although there may be sufficient cause for being unhappy, one should avoid counteracting such reversals. For the more we become implicated in rectifying such reversals, the more we enter the darkest regions of material anxiety. Lord Krishna has also advised us in this connection. One should tolerate things instead of becoming agitated. And to illustrate this purport, I want to share a little story from my own life. Because very often when I discuss this point, this question comes up. But, you know, is it really like that? That, you know, let's say at work and the working field and so on, we should never defend ourselves. Where will we get at if we apply this? And, right? So we have to very carefully look at things, whether it's all worthwhile. You know? Yes. And I want to share one situation that I experienced. That's quite a few years ago, some 10, 12 years ago. The German taxation department charged me unfairly, completely unfairly, some 1,500 euros they asked me to pay, which I was not meant to pay. Yes. So they sent me this letter, and I was traveling, and somebody else accepted the letter on my behalf, but didn't open the letter, you know, and tell me what was in the letter. So when I received this letter, it was, you know, 4 or 5 months afterwards. And I had a 3 months period where I could object to this payment, but because I didn't get this letter in time, I missed that period. So, and when I got this letter, well, as you can imagine, I was furious, you know. What is this? Why are they charging me this money, which I was not meant to pay? It was completely unfair and unjust and, you know. So, of course, my ego, this is ridiculous. And I immediately rang this woman there in the taxation department. So, and then she was saying, well, sorry, you didn't protest in these first 3 months and you missed the time. And, well, if you like, you can take the matter to court and, you know. So, and already just talking to this woman, oh, my God, I was completely agitated, you know. And I was... all this, you know, ego thing started, and oh, I felt so contaminated and agitated and angry, and you know. So, and then I remembered this purport. And I started thinking, no, it's not worth it. Let him have it, okay. You know, maybe I owed them something. I haven't paid much taxes in this life. You know, so all right, let him have it. 1,500 euros, you know, quite a bit of money. But I thought, not worth it, you know. Because really, it's exactly what Prabhupada is saying, you know. One should avoid counteracting such reversals. For the more we become implicated in rectifying such reversals, the more we enter into the darkest region of material anxiety, exactly that I experienced immediately. You know? Yeah, my whole bhajan and sadhana was out the window and I was completely disturbed, and of course I couldn't chant, you know. And while I was chanting, I was just having this whole discussion in my mind there with this woman from the taxation department. And I just was completely sucked into this deepest, darkest region of material anxiety. And I just started realizing, no, let's tolerate. All right, you know, I haven't paid much tax in this lifetime, so obviously I was meant to pay something there and what to do, and all right, let him have it. But it took me a few days to, you know, shake this off and let go of this, you know? And the ego is demanding, please, everybody, my God, whenever we enter a seminar, let's just switch off everybody, switch off your phones, you know? Yeah, so that's exactly the ego's demands, that the ego wants justice and fairness, and oh, how can they treat me like this, and. That's exactly how the ego responds, you know? Oh, a little version we just had with these books here at the customs, you know, a smaller version of this, you know. They were also calculating things wrongly, and I was paying too much to them, actually. But, and also, I was, I should go there and I should talk to them, and how is it that they're calculating like this, and blah, you know. But anyway, it's not worth it. All right, some mistakes, and let it go, you know. Yes. So this is just an example for you, you know, to understand, yes, even in some situations in material life there, you know, at work or with the taxation department or whatever it may be, one has to very carefully look, is it really worthwhile trying to rectify, you know, and counteract some situation there, or am I just getting sucked into some whole thing there, you know, some material anxiety, and one thing leads to another thing, and then we get all entangled just to get our right and, you know. One has to very carefully look. And even though externally, in a material sense, we might be ending up like the loser, right? Of me having to pay €1,500 to the taxation department. It looks really like I'm the loser here. But ultimately, you know, just by letting it go and not being disturbed, actually we are the winner, actually. Yeah, I guess for the recordings it is helpful. Let us see if the cable is long enough to, and whether we can quickly enough pass it around. But we are not there yet in questions, so let's do this quietly, and we'll continue here while you're setting things up. So in any case, you know, we have to be very mindful and always weigh up. Is it really worthwhile? And that's the point with tolerance. With a material vision, these days, nobody wants to cultivate tolerance. Tolerance in material life is seen as being the loser. It is seen as weakness. You cannot stand up for yourself. In material life, tolerance is seen to be a weakness. What? You tolerating that? I'm not going to tolerate this. I'm going to walk out. I'm going to get divorced. How long should I tolerate this nonsense? You know? So in material life, you know, to fight back, that's seen as a sign of strength, not to tolerate. But in spiritual terms, it's the other way around. Tolerance is the strength. Tolerance is glorious. At the latest, at the point of death, because then our false ego is dissolved and we're going to sneak home back to God through the back door there, you know, by having learned how to tolerate. So at the latest, at that point, we will be the winner, right? And fighting back and defending is very short-term, we are the winner. Short-term. But long-term, we are the loser because we are protecting and defending our egos. Right? Yes. Yeah, so, you know, things from a spiritual vision, very different than from materialistic vision. Opposite. What is victory and glory in material life is being a loser in spiritual life and vice versa. Yes, that's how it is, actually. I've got one more nice thing here in regards to tolerance. Here, 11, 19, 36 to 38. You've got the number also on your piece of paper, but not the quote. Tolerance means to patiently endure unhappiness, such as that provoked by the insults or negligence of others. In other words, what is most difficult for the false ego to tolerate is when we are neglected and ignored, or when we are insulted. These are the two things which are really hard to tolerate. Being insulted or being neglected. Yes. So tolerance means that even in such a provocative situation where we are insulted or neglected, that we simply, patiently endure that without getting agitated. That's tolerance. So now sometimes people ask, well, but, you know, how much can we tolerate? You know? And when we tolerate, then, oh, there's so much negativity building up, and sooner or later we explode, or this negativity leads to disease and depression and so many things. So we have to distinguish between true tolerance and just bottling up, putting the cork on things and suppressing. Right? So when we have this negativity building up inside, that's not true tolerance. Then we are just suppressing things, but internally the ego battle continues. The ego is still demanding justice, fairness, this, that, and still rebelling, protesting, and we're just putting the cork on the bottle there. That's not tolerance. That's not tolerance. We have to be clear on that. You know? If we experience that kind of situation in our life, we have to understand we are not tolerating. We're just suppressing, but we are not letting go of the ego's demands. We're just suppressing them, but they still continue internally. And then all this negativity builds up and sooner or later we explode. But true tolerance is when we let it go. We let it go by. We let it pass. We give it up. We throw it overboard. That's a different thing. Huh? Let me explain one more thing and then I will see if there's some questions. There is two tools we have to have in order to tolerate. Two important tools. What are they? What two important qualities we need to have in order to be able to cultivate tolerance? Humility. Yes, humility is one of them. Only a humble person can tolerate. Proud person will always think, oh, you know, they don't know. Who am I? How can they treat me like this? You know, so humility is one of them. Without humility, no chance to tolerate. So the second one now is a very different one. Humility, we can say, has so many secondary manifestations, like patience, gratitude, this, that. They're all actually secondary manifestations of tolerance, humility. You know, only a humble person will be grateful. Only a humble person will be a patient. Only a humble person will be whatever. So don't go in that direction of looking for secondary manifestations of humility. The second one is something pretty different, something we have to have. Who said that? Faith? Exactly. Yeah, very good. Faith in Krishna, unflinching faith in Krishna. Without that faith in Krishna, we cannot tolerate. Very true. Very true. Good. Usually it takes longer until somebody comes up with that, and sometimes nobody comes up with that, and I have to say it. Yes. Faith in Krishna. If we have faith in Krishna, then we can connect any situation with Krishna being behind it. We can see Krishna's hand in it. We can understand, well, there must be some reason that Krishna puts me in this situation. What is Krishna trying to teach me here? Right? But if we don't have faith in Krishna, we cannot even connect our situation with Krishna being behind it. We cannot connect. Yeah? And humble person, humble Vaishnav mood is, actually I deserve so much more than this. But Krishna is so kind, he only gives me one drop of what I really deserve. Right? That's the Vaishnav mood. But again, that vision we can only have if we have faith in Krishna. And that's one reason, according to my humble realization, this is one reason why even we ISKCON devotees in these modern days, we often cannot tolerate, because we actually lack faith in Krishna. That's the problem. You know, even in our struggles in married life and we often just fail to see Krishna behind it. We fail to see what lesson is Krishna trying to teach me here. There must be some reason. Not a blade of grass that's moving without Krishna being in control. So there must be some good reason why I'm in this situation. Maybe from some past activities in this life or previous life or whatever, you know. So, but if we have that faith in Krishna, we can see Krishna in the picture, in any situation, you know. And then we have that faith, yes, Krishna will help me, Krishna will give me the strength to deal with the situation. And another thing is also that the more our relationship with Krishna is established, the more that becomes our actual reality, my relationship with Krishna. And this is a good thing to keep in the back of your mind, that, you know, whenever we are in some agitating situation, we can try and make these two steps back, and we can ask ourselves, is this important at the moment of death? Has this any importance, this 1,500 euros I paid to the taxation department? Is this of any significance at the moment of death? No, it's not. You know? No, it's not. So, it's just part of this nonsensical stage performance, which has no real significance, actually. It's just some temporary crazy circus here. But the real actual reality, eternal reality. Eternal reality is my relationship with Krishna. That's what really counts. So the more our relationship with Krishna is established, the more we can take shelter there. And we can say to ourselves, thank God, this has nothing to do with my relationship with Krishna. And then whatever agitating situation may be there loses its importance, because we realize at the moment of death, damn insignificant, no importance. So let's just drop it. Let's drop it. Let it go by. Shake it off. Throw it overboard. Yeah, and I mean, in the Shastra, we have a lot of nice examples. Even when Parikshit Maharaj got cursed, you know, he could have easily counteracted the curse. But he didn't. He did not defend. He accepted it. You know? And he inquired, so, what is a person meant to be doing who is facing death? And the whole Bhagavatam was spoken. You know? Yes. Or even Chitraketu, when Parvati cursed him, you know? You may remember the story, Shiva and Parvati sitting there together, Parvati on Shiva's lap, and Chitraketu came past making some jokes. Oh, what's this here? Since when are we sitting with our wife like this in the assembly of saints and sages? So, and you know, Chitraketu, Shiva didn't get agitated, but Parvati did. She got all emotional. The nature of us ladies. And she overreacted. Who are you to talk to my husband like this? Don't you know who he is? And she cursed him to take birth as a demon, Vitrasura. And Chitraketu could have easily counteracted the curse, but he didn't. He didn't. He gave this whole speech, okay, Mother Parvati, if you think this is the right thing, then I'm happy to take birth as a demon. For a devotee, no difference whether in a demon's body or in a divine body, it's all the same. And so he gave a whole eloquent speech there, and then she realized, oh my God, he's actually a self-realized soul, you know. Yes, yes. So, but these are all powerful examples. They did not defend, you know. They did not defend. But how would we act? Oh, I'll show her, I'll finish her off, You know, that's probably how, you know, we would have acted or something, you know, immediately retaliate and shoot back and all this kind of thing, you know. Yes. Also a nice example from the Shastra is King Rahugana, when he was carried on the palanquin by Jadabharat, and Jadabharat was walking all funny there because he was trying to avoid stepping on the ants. So, and then King Rahugana got on his case, chastised him, "Who are you to, you know, carry me like this? I'm the king, and can't you walk properly?" So, and then Jadabharat gave this whole speech, "So today you are the king and I'm the carrier, and tomorrow it could be the other way around." The caps, you know, the false designations he was talking about, right? How we should not identify them with them, how they're temporary roles, and. So, and King Rahugana, what did he do? Immediately he jumped off the palanquin and paid obeisances. Yes. You know, he could have very easily also defended, "Well, how are you talking to me like this? I'm the king, I'm going to get arrest you, I'm going to get you killed." You know, king has that power. But he didn't, you know. He realized, oh, okay, he's a self-realized soul. He took immediately the humble position, didn't defend, you know. That's the Vaishnava mood, you know. But then other examples, Daksha, Indra, they're always getting, you know, proud and feel threatened and they defend, and then conflict comes, you know. Then immediately some conflict comes, you know. So we have so many nice stories in that regard from the Shastra, you know. And I mean, even in preaching, very easily we also can get caught on the ego platform in book distribution. Whoever has been out on book distribution has that experience, that sometimes it's really agitating for the false ego, you know, when people don't want to take a book. And sometimes hard for the devotee to accept a no, right? And continues pushing, or wants to be the winner, winning the ego battle there, that the person takes the book. I once heard a nice story from Russia, book distribution. One devotee was distributing books on the service station where the trucks fill in the diesel. So, and he was hitting up the truck drivers, distributing books to them. So there was one truck driver, he didn't want to take a book. He said, "No, thank you, I'm not interested." So a devotee couldn't accept the no for a no, you know. He was pushing, continuing. So then the truck driver started driving, you know, he started up the truck. So what did the devotee do? He jumped on the back of the truck. Couldn't give in. So he jumped on the back of the truck. Truck driver started driving, 10 kilometers, 20, 30, 40, 50, devotee in the back. You know? So then finally he was knocking on the driver's cabin there. "Oh, please stop, let me get off the truck," you know. So and then it took him half of the day to hitchhike back to, you know, the service station where he had parked his car. So, I mean, the nice example, you know, of how the false ego, even in preaching, gets into our way, constant companion and troublemaker, you know, because we can't be humble and accept a no for a no. Because even the person on the street also gets sometimes caught in this ego battle of wanting to say no, you know, right? You ever experienced that? Yes, yes. No, not going to take one. I'm not going to take one, you know. And then very easily the devotee gets caught in this ego battle there, and then it's just the ego is battling out there. And that contaminates the whole experience, you know. That's why the recommendation is always to try and not get caught on this ego platform, you know. And if a person says no, then still be friendly. "Okay, have a nice day. It was nice talking to you. Thank you for taking your time and talking to me," you know, and leaving a nice experience, because then immediately that dissolves the other person's ego, it melts the other person's heart, and the other person will think, oh God, that person was so friendly, even though I didn't take a book, but he was so nice, wished me a nice day. You know, and the next time he will take one, you know. But if we end up in this ego battle there, then it becomes a very unpleasant and distasteful experience, actually for both sides, for both sides. I'm sure we have that experience that, you know, actually here on your sheet I wrote, ego bounces back and forth like ping pong ball. That's really what happens. You know, if somebody attacks you from the ego platform, then immediately your own false ego gets ignited and you shoot back on the ego platform, and like that the ego bounces back and forwards like a ping pong ball. And this is highly contaminating. Yes. Especially this happens over internet, in all kinds of internet discussions and debates. Devotees should not take part in this, because it's highly contaminating, highly contaminating. This debating where people are not in a humble frame of mind wanting to hear and inquire, but where people just want to push through their opinion that they are right. And then no matter what you say, they twist it around and make it into a weapon and shoot it back at you. You know, and then if half the world reads this, you feel like, oh, well, I have to say something about this. I can't just leave it at that. Otherwise, everybody thinks that is right, you know. So then you get sucked in, you say something again, and then boom, the same thing happens. And it goes on and on and on. There's no end to it. Right? You've ever experienced these things? Yes? Or is it only me here? I just completely stay away from it. Completely stay away. Because it's so contaminating. You know, you feel all this ugly feeling in the heart, all this agitation and anger, and the mind is all agitated. And that's the contaminating effect of the false ego. Highly contaminating. Doesn't lead to any good. So devotee, better as a devotee, we don't take part in this. Hare Krishna. Okay, let it be whatever it is, Hare Krishna, and we just withdraw. We don't engage in this, because there's no upliftment there for nobody. You know, it's a whole ego battle and fight there, and it only agitates and contaminates. Yeah. Okay, so let me see if we have any questions on this. Yes.
Hare Krishna. My question is regarding this defending or not defending. We heard many times even Prabhupada said that even if you have strong ego, if you're more kshatriya nature, if you like to have this kind of rasas to fight, or, you know, to engage your ego, false ego, in the service of Krishna. So what is actually, like you mentioned, we get sucked into this negativity. Should we stay more neutral or distance, or should we actually fight for, I don't know, to defend devotees, or to defend some principles, or to defend some philosophy, or things like that?
Well, even defending, you know, devotees, defending guru, defending Krishna consciousness. Shall I wait until you translate the question or what?
No, just
even if we defend devotees or Krishna or the philosophy, if it is done with false ego, it will not be purifying. That's the whole point. Even in preaching, you know? Even when we are meant to defend other devotees, still it should not come with ego. You know? Because then also the ego has just that contaminating effect. Doesn't matter what we do, it contaminates. So the way how we engage, you know, passion is more by in a positive way, or the fighting spirit. I mean, I have heard or read Prabhupada saying that, you know, this fighting spirit, we should actually engage in fighting against our own demoniac tendencies in the heart. That's a good way how to engage the fighting spirit. You know? Yes, yes. Or to some extent, yes, you know, in book distribution, we can burn up a little bit of passion there, going out and working hard and so on. You know, but at the same time, we have to hear, you know, these kind of discussions about the false ego, because eventually we have to subdue it. We have to get off it. We can't just think, oh, let's just engage the ego and, because later on or tomorrow morning, depending on how far we are getting today, we can also feed and blow up the ego, you know, and then we're not getting anywhere. So it's a tricky thing. We have to really look at the individual situation. What is the best way, you know, how to do things? Yes.
I was thinking about we hear in modern psychology that some healthy ego boundaries should be set, and I was remembering this Bhagavatam story where a snake was a devotee and it was teased or something and said, oh, but I'm a devotee, I should not bite now. And then I think, was it Narada Muni? Somebody said, oh, you just show your teeth but don't bite, as if like you should set some boundaries but don't harm. Is that a healthy way of kind of, you know?
It depends on the situation, you know. It's a little hard to generalize like this without a concrete situation. But yeah, I mean, to show your teeth but not biting, you know, so that, I mean, like, see, Prabhupada demonstrated so many situations where he was bitterly fighting, you know, for so many projects, Juhu and Mumbai. My God, Prabhupada was leading whole battles. But it was not from the ego platform, absolutely not, you know. That's a different thing. Prabhupada was completely free from ego platform. He was fighting for Krishna. You know, nothing else, not from ego. So, and that's why he was victorious, you know, yes. And I mean, in this regard, there's also the nice story, I mentioned it briefly here, story of Sakshi Gopal, you know, where the old Brahmana promises the young Brahmana his daughter in marriage in front of Sakshi Gopal. So, and then later on, the old Brahmana changes his mind because his relatives are saying, what, are you crazy? How can you give this young Brahmana who's got no money or nothing, give our daughter? So he's changing his mind. So and the young Brahmana, you know, he's going to the deity, to Sakshi Gopal, and he's saying, you know, they're breaking the promise they made in front of you. So I don't want that they are getting that reaction for breaking the promise. So he was following up on the whole thing, but not for his own sake. You know? The reason why he followed up on this was not that he was on this ego platform, oh, they promised me the daughter, and now they're not giving, and what is this, and boo, I should have, you know, the daughter in marriage. No, that was not his motive. His only concern was that this old Brahmana would get a heavy reaction for breaking his promise, which he did in front of the deity. And he did not want that to happen. And he did not want to have that decline in standards and values, that we promise something in front of a deity and then we don't follow. you know. So that's why he went to the deity and said, so you please, you know, come to me, come with me to the village there, you know. And he says, and then the deity says, oh, Sakshi Gopal says, well, how can I go there? And then the Brahmana says, well, if you can talk, then you can walk, you know. So, and then Sakshi Gopal agreed to walk behind him as long as he wouldn't turn around. So obviously, Sakshi Gopal, the deity, would have not agreed to walk to the village if this Brahmana had just acted on some ego thing there of wanting his justice and, you know. But because the motive of the Brahmana was pure, his concern was the welfare of this old Brahmana, that he doesn't break his promise. That's why Krishna agreed to walk with him, you know. So it's a nice example to illustrate that if your motive is pure, you know, and if you're not acting on the ego platform, just like Prabhupada was fighting for with a pure reason, you know, so then Krishna, you know, helps and comes along and does the needful, you know. But if we're just acting on some ego platform there, just trying to win the match or something, or be right or whatever, that will not attract Krishna's blessings and support and so on, you know. So we have to see, you know, that even if we fight and defend and so on, we are not doing this on ego platform there, you know. Anybody has any other thing about defending, tolerating?
What about if there is abusive situation?
Abusive. Of course, you know, abusive situation is never. We can never justify and sanction any kind of abusive situation. So, again, you know, if there's an abusive situation, other devotees should defend, you know. And it depends, you know, to what extent really abuse is happening and you know, it requires some deeper investigation and so on. But to some extent, you know, even there also, you know, a devotee has that understanding. Well, there must be some reason that this is happening to me. Maybe I did the same thing to the person in the previous life or something. I mean, nothing happens out of the blue or something, you know. Which does, of course, not mean that we say, oh, to see, you're just getting your karma here or something. There's always two points of views on these things, you know. Like when something negative happens, the Vaishnava mood of the person who experiences it, he should think, well, there must be some reason that I'm suffering like this, you know. As I was saying, the Vaishnava mood is actually, I deserve so much more than this, but Krishna is so kind. You know, he gives me only one drop. But that doesn't mean the others are saying like that, oh, actually, you deserve so much more, but Krishna only gives you one drop. No. Right? We should be thinking like that, but other people should not say like that or think like that. So there's always two angles of vision to it. The person who experiences it, he should feel like that. That's the Vaishnava mood. But it doesn't mean that we can use that to justify. I mean, this is happening in all situations, you know. Maybe you heard in New Zealand was some big shooting there in the mosque and. So whenever anything happens, you know, some killing, some murder, well, we know there is the laws of karma. Hey, you know, nothing happens without a good reason. But it doesn't mean now that we say, oh, well, it's just your karma. You got killed. Well, it's your karma. No, of course we don't say like that. Right? But the person who is experiencing that should understand, well, there must be some reason for this. You know? That's what the laws of karma means. That nothing happens as a coincidence or something. It doesn't matter what it is. Huh? That's our philosophy, isn't it? No?
I'm asking you. And so this is internal, and what about externally? How he or she should behave in such situation?
Well, of course, it depends what kind of abuse it is. If it is some sexual abuse or violence or emotional abuse, of course, abuse is abuse and it has to be followed up and something has to be done. And of course, that's the laws. Huh? Yes. But, nevertheless, it's the same thing when we are killed. Of course, it has to go to the police and somebody has to follow up and there will be some court case and. But, you know, spiritually seen, we know there's the laws of karma and there's some reason why this happens. Nothing happens, not a blade of grass is moving without Krishna being in control, right? No? Doesn't matter what it is. Whether it's murder or this or that or abuse, it doesn't matter what it is, war, you know, earthquake, whatever it may be, tsunami, whatever it may be, whatever. It's not that abuse is some separate situation which is not according to the laws of karma or something, right? Yeah, so well, this is our philosophy, you know. Right? Yeah, but it doesn't mean that we don't do anything about it. It doesn't mean that we justify it and say, oh, well, that's your bad luck, it's your karma. No, we don't say that, of course not. Well, we always do everything to alleviate any kind of suffering. You know?
Yeah, because it often happens, like you mentioned that other devotees should do something about, but it often happens, like sometimes it can happen behind the closed doors, like in the family, when there is like maybe not even the witness, others maybe even don't know, or they know but they don't want to do anything.
So, yeah, well, yeah. It's a bit off the topic, you know. I cannot allow myself to get into a whole thing now, how to deal with abuse or something, you know. It's a different thing. But I'm describing in this book here also two kinds of violence. There's violence to the gross body and there's violence to the subtle body. And men sometimes, and let's say any violence is unjustified. Any violence is an offense. Any violence is a perverted form of establishing our superiority. So men sometimes lash out in violence to the gross body, and we women are very expert in performing violence to the subtle body of a man. And that often is, not only often, always is unrecognized. You know? A woman who is experiencing violence, she's got something to show. She's got a blue eye or black eye or a broken arm or whatever. But a man who experiences the violence to the subtle body, he's got nothing to show. And there is a verse in the Bhagavatam. It's all in there. There's a verse in the Bhagavatam which describes that the violence, that the arrow piercing a person's heart, that is not as painful as the harsh and insulting words piercing a person's heart. That's much more painful. Much more. So I'm always suggesting, let's make a deal. The men stop performing violence to the gross body and we women stop performing violence to the subtle body. Yes. Woman's energy is very powerful and women's harsh words, they're like 1,000 arrows cutting up a man's heart into pieces and we don't even realize. We don't even realize how often we lash out in that form of violence. Yes. So, you know, violence in family, it's a big topic. Let's look a little deeper. How this happens? Is it only him who is violent, or maybe she is, you know, shooting her arrows there, and the poor man just his fuse bursts and, you know, he can't tolerate it anymore or something. So there's always so many sides to the story. It has to be looked deeply. What is actually the real cause? Yes. Not so easy, you know. We tend to always take the side of a woman. Oh, the husband is beating her or whatever. I know a few situations where, boy, you know, she was torturing the poor man with her arrows there, you know, until he exploded, you know. Yeah. So one has to look a little deeper to really get to the roots of the whole issue, you know. Yeah. Anyway, but there's a whole thing in this book. If you want to know more, then please get this book. Yes, Prabhu, you wanted to say something?
Hare Krishna, I would like to ask something regarding to this violence. Like, we know that this life is not something romantic. There is all the time something happening. There is all the time something that you are in struggle with. And also, the Bhagavad Gita was spoken on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. So, isn't like that we have to suffer a little bit to get advanced spiritually, or there should be some violence?
Anyway, let's get back to the topic, if you don't mind. Let's get back to the topic of false ego, and not let's not get off the track here now with violence and this and that, if you don't mind, because that was my request in the very beginning, that the questions have to be to the topic. Otherwise, I will lose myself here and get off a different track, and then we end up somewhere else, and we don't continue with our topic. Okay? Okay, any other question about tolerance and defending?
My humble obeisances to you. I speak English not so good. Please translate. Torej, če je človek toleranten, to pa še ne pomeni, da ne bi smel na en dostojanstven...
Maybe let her just ask her questions and then you...
Če je človek toleranten, to pa še ne pomeni, da ne bi smel na en dostojanstven način odreagirati. Torej, reakcija človeka, ki je na visoki ravni tolerance. Ali odreagira ali ne, vendar na en dostojanstven način.
If a person is put in a difficult situation and if a person is tolerant, should we say that the person can also respond but not react in a certain situation in a dignified way? So not to just freeze and step aside, but to respond, not to react, but to respond in a dignified way. Is that also a way of tolerance, but also setting some boundaries and ground?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little abstract for me to understand really what exactly she means. I mean, to tolerate does not mean that we just, you know, bite our tongue and shut up and, you know, no, it's an internal thing of letting go of that ego, you know, demand of getting that ego satisfaction. That's what it means to tolerate, not to just shut up or something, you know. But not to hang on to this you know, desire to get that ego satisfaction, but just to accept and, you know, let it go by and whatever. Yes? How to let it go, yes. So let us now discuss these steps, which I already announced. I already announced we would discuss. Let us imagine you know, we are in a situation where we do the wrong thing. We defend, you know, we answer back like that, right? And we realize, oh, again, I'm doing the wrong thing. So, because the ego's pushings are not so easy to control. They're very strong. They're very strong. Not so easy to just from one day to the other to let go of these ego patterns of behaviors, because we've been carrying this false ego for so many lifetimes, so many. We are so caught in these patterns of behaviors, so not so strong to overcome them. So, actually, these steps are not on your sheet, so you better write them down. And we can nicely use these steps for any kind of internal transformation where we want to let go of some patterns of behaviors. Whether this is ego pattern or whether this is envy or whatever it may be, for any kind of internal transformational work, these steps are applicable. So step number one is always hearing about the topic. So we become mindful, we become conscious, we become aware of it. So that's what we are doing here now in the seminar. We are discussing in all details how the ego affects us and, so that we become more mindful of it, that we recognize. Otherwise, without such hearing, we are unconscious in that regard, and we don't even realize. Right? So hearing is always the first step, that we hear. And that wakes us up from this unconsciousness, from the spiritual coma. So then when we hear, second step should be that we desire to let go of these certain patterns of behavior. That we realize, my God, I have to do something about this. I have to let go of these mechanisms which the ego is always trapping me in. So a burning desire to transform, to change, to develop certain qualities, right? That should be the next step after hearing, you know, that we desire to develop the respective quality. So then the third step, maybe I should ask you, what do you think? What's the third step? After hearing and desiring, what's the third step? Don't shout out. Just lift your hand. Otherwise, if everybody talks, I can't hear anything. Huh?
Some action.
Some action. Any other?
To make a plan.
Some other. Anyway, let's just speed it up, and I'll tell you. That time is going. Now, step number three is to be introspective. To be introspective and honest. To honestly look within our hearts. Why am I saying this? Why am I doing this? Am I a humble servant here, or am I just trying to be the controller and right after all and? You know, without introspection and honesty, we cannot make advancement, actually. Because as I was sharing, was it this morning or yesterday, how the intelligence gets so affected by the false ego, and the intelligence distorts things and always finds its justifications why we are right and everybody else is wrong. You know? So without this introspection and honesty, we will always cheat ourselves. The ego will get its way. Right? So introspection and honesty is absolutely required to make any spiritual progress. Otherwise, we will just maintain all our attachments and patterns of behavior and the ego satisfaction there and. Without introspection and honesty, no chance, no chance, no chance. So then, step number four. We catch ourselves doing the wrong thing. That's already progress. Yes, because, you know, 6 months earlier, we probably didn't even realize that we do the wrong thing. But now we realize, oh, again, I was defending. Oh, again, I was answering back. I had to have the last word. I was trying to prove that I'm right. And, you know. So we catch ourselves doing the wrong thing. That's progress. Because for so many years we were doing all these things and we didn't even think anything of it. We didn't think it was wrong. We thought we had all the reasons to answer back and, you know? So we catch ourselves doing the wrong thing. So then, fifth step. What do you think? What do? When we catch ourselves doing the wrong thing? Yes, we cry to Krishna, exactly. We cry out to Krishna, Krishna, help, please, you know, relieve me from this demon, you know, this demoniac quality of always wanting to be right and be superior and. It's actually a demoniac quality, you know. So that's the point. We, out of our own endeavor, we actually cannot really free ourselves from this ego patterns of behavior, because it's so subtle, so deep, for so many lifetimes. Huh? What? Yes, crying, praying, exactly. You know? Cryingly praying. Cry out to Krishna. Yes. That's why Guru Govinda Maharaj says an ISKCON temple is a crying school, where we learn how to cry out to Krishna. So you've got a pretty good crying school here, so now let's learn how to cry out to Krishna. Yes, now Krishna's our only hope, actually. But see, the point is, we are not so sincerely inviting Krishna to uproot this ego satisfaction, because we are still hoping that it will give us some tasty fruit, some sense gratification, to be right, and to, you know, be the center of attention, and. So we are hanging on to it, you know? Yes. So Krishna only will relieve us from this if we actually sincerely beg him to come and enter our heart and do this heart surgery there. Lord Nrisingadev, very expert in performing the heart surgery. Yeah, so we have to sincerely invite him, you know, but usually we don't. We say, all right, Krishna, you can take this attachment, but not that one. You know, that one is very dear to me. I will hang on to that one for a bit longer. You can't take that one. You know, so depending on how sincerely we call upon Krishna to really help us get rid of this ego, he will respond. Yes. So, and especially when we chant, that's when we are meant to call out to Krishna, you know, when we chant our japa. You know? Yes. So, lamenting, crying out to Krishna, that's step number five. So, what's step number six? No. Well, let's put it that way. If we do these three steps of introspection in honesty, catching ourselves doing the wrong thing, crying out to Krishna, If we do these three things again and again and again, then sooner or later, oi, monkeys. Yeah, the monkeys also. So, if we do these three steps, introspection and honesty, catching ourselves doing the wrong thing, crying out to Krishna and lamenting. If we do that internal work, and it's hard, internal work, then sooner or later we will catch ourselves doing the right thing. That's step number six. Guaranteed. We will come to a situation where we think, wow, you know, some few weeks before, I would have reacted differently. I would have taken up the bait and I would have, you know, defended and argued and whatever. But now, amazingly, I can just let it go by. I can just not react to it. I can just ignore it. I can just let go of it. Yes. Some little situation will come where we realize, wow, now I was able to do the right thing. And we realize, actually, it's not me doing it. It's by Krishna's mercy, because Krishna is helping us. He is responding to our crying out. So, and that's the internal work we have to do. You know, this introspection in honesty. Actually, as a devotee, we always have to introspect. We always have to be mindful. Why am I doing this? Why am I saying this? What's my motive? You know, it should almost become like our second nature, that we are sensitized towards ourselves and why we're doing things. It's very subtle, you know, the false ego is so subtle. But unless we are introspective and sensitized and mindful and aware and conscious of our behavior and how we are reacting, you know, very difficult to get out of this. So it's hard work, you know. But if a devotee agrees to do this internal hard work, that's when we actually make spiritual advancement. That's when we get purified, when we do this internal work. When was it? Yesterday or this morning the question came up, you know, about success, external success, internal success. You know, so that's the ultimate success, actually, when we do this internal work. All our external success at the moment of death is not that significant, you know. What really counts is, well, have I worked on my false ego? Have I dissolved that? Because, you know, see, Satchinanda Swami makes this nice analogy. He says, in our heart, there is like a throne, an asana. And this asana is meant for Krishna to take his seat there. But who is sitting there at the moment? The big fat false ego is sitting on the throne. I'm the center. I am it. You know? Yes. Yes. So, you know, with this big fat false ego sitting there on the throne in the heart, there's no room for Krishna there. You know? So, and if we want to actually develop bhakti, we have to push this false ego off the seat so that Krishna can take a seat there. So, and only then we can actually develop love for Krishna. You know, if there's some arrogance and pride and big ego there, the heart is not prepared to develop bhakti. Right? So we have to do that work. Otherwise, no chance to get out of here. You know, even though we might have achieved so many big things in our life or something, but at the moment of death, oh, well, too bad. We have to do another round in the material world, you know. Yes. Yeah, so these are the these six steps. you know, which we can actually apply for any kind of transformational work we want to do, you know. Yeah, and especially getting rid of the ego. We have to appeal to Krishna. We have to cry out to Krishna and invite him to and beg him to relieve us from this. And I mean, again, married life offers so much opportunity for this. So much opportunity, my God, you know? Yes. That's why it is such a purifying journey, you know? It's really the battlefield for false egos is married life. Definitely. Some big sighs are there in the back. Yes, well. No private talking, please. Any questions or comments on this? On these six steps there of internal work?
The number 3, 4, and 5, you said?
Yes.
It must be done?
Yes.
So I find myself in 3 and 4, but have very much trouble in 5. But to cry or pray, I have some bad experience in a few years back, and I stopped praying.
Maybe some bad experience because you think Krishna didn't react properly to your prayers, or what was the bad experience in praying? How can there be a bad experience in praying? I cannot even understand.
I pray, but it gets only worse and worse and worse for a long time.
Well, you know, we have to look at how we pray and what we pray about. And, you know, I mean, Krishna is not the order supplier that, oh, Krishna, please fix the situation or something. You know, so it depends a little bit. I mean, Krishna has his ways to react to prayers, which might just not what we expect, but Krishna has his reasons. You know? There's always something that Krishna wants to show us and teach us. And obviously, you know, we had to go through some hardship there to maybe more sincerely pray, you know? I mean, that's what the Shikshastikam says, even if you handle me roughly with your embrace, or you're not present before me, still, you are my worshipful Lord, birth after birth. You know, so just that, because Krishna didn't react the way we wanted it or something, so now we stop praying. Hey, what's that? You know? Huh? Yeah, then, so obviously Krishna's trying to teach you, you know? we cannot be too fruitive or too we cannot be materially motivated there in our prayers, you know. I mean, the mood of our prayers should be, oh Krishna, please, you know, help me, and whatever you do with me, I will just serve you anyway. And again, I'm only getting one drop of what I should really get, you know, what I'm really deserving. So if we have unflinching faith in Krishna and we can connect our situation with Krishna being behind it, then this, you know, just the way things didn't go the way we expected it or something, it should not lead to the fact that we stop praying or something. You know, so Krishna is testing us. How much faith do we have? And. There's no other way. There's no other solution, you know, except calling out for Krishna. And I mean, see, any unfortunate situation, any calamity, a devotee can turn around and make it into an opportunity. We only need the eyes to see. You know? As I shared this morning, even cancer, chemotherapy, you can turn around and make it into a fantastic opportunity. You know? If you have a spiritual vision of things, then any calamity can become the greatest opportunity. And if we actually surrender and call out, then Krishna reciprocates. He definitely does. He is more present before us. Definitely. I mean, I was diagnosed 2 times with cancer. I definitely experienced that. You know, if we actually put our life in Krishna's hands, okay, Krishna, here I am, whatever you do with me, I'm ready to accept. You know, then Krishna becomes more tangibly present there. He responds, definitely. But if we think, oh, what is this? I've been chanting Hare Krishna for 30 years and now I have cancer. Oh, probably Krishna doesn't even exist. How can he give me such a situation? Oh, well, that's a very mundane way of dealing with calamities. Any kind of suffering, Krishna always gives us, the deeper meaning of any suffering is to make us more surrender to him, to take shelter of him. That's the purport of any suffering. Do you know? Yes. Yes. So, and just that because Krishna doesn't react the way we expect and relieves us of our misery or something, that shouldn't be a reason to stop praying or something. No, no. That's a mundane way of looking at things. Even if he handles me roughly by his embrace, he is my Lord and Master. I am his servant. Yes?
I have one question. We usually run away from painful situations where our false ego can be hurt, and there's some fear of pain which is attached to that. And usually our response is to just don't go in such situations because we are afraid of pain, which is, I guess, false ego attachment to some things, whatever. So how go about this pain, which I think is present and that, which, like you said, it's not gross pain, but usually it's inner pain, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. When the ego gets offended, it is almost a physical pain, you know? The heart is really, it's so much in pain, you know? Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's a fact. It's a fact. Again, first step is always to realize that it's actually with us as spirit soul, it actually has nothing to do. You know? It's just a temporary thing and the pain comes actually from the ego. I mean, good to understand that, to make our intelligence a bit spiritual so we recognize, we understand, you know? I mean, yeah, what to say? As a devotee, we try and have that attitude to understand, okay, thank you, Krishna, for giving me the opportunity to cultivate tolerance, because tolerance is so important to develop. So, I mean, that's my way how I deal with things, you know, that I consciously try to be grateful for these opportunities. I see them, I turn it around and make it into an opportunity. You know, the painful and disappointing calamity, you turn around as an opportunity to learn tolerance. Because it's such an important quality, such an important quality. You know, as we were saying, it's, we can directly measure a person's spiritual strength and advancement and how much he can tolerate. You know, and the shastras are full of examples of it, of great personalities tolerating so much, you know. Yes, and we take shelter in Krishna. Yeah. That we say to ourselves, this has nothing to do with my relationship with Krishna. It's a different reality. And we take shelter in that eternal reality of my relationship with Krishna. That's how Prahlad Maharaj Das Thakur, that's the only way how they could tolerate so much, because they were firmly established in their relationship with Krishna. You know? And then they could take shelter there. They could escape in that reality. And then what else goes on there is just part of the nonsensical stage performance of the crazy circus. You know? So it very much depends on how much our relationship with Krishna is established through the chanting. Monday, tomorrow morning we have one session, and then Monday evening we have the last session from 5 to 7. So please bring your beads on that Monday evening session. I do want to make one chanting exercise with you. The circle will be closed by getting back to the chanting. Okay. Well, 7:15. Let me see what we have. I mean, the next thing we have already discussed for the ladies, we dissolve our ego by putting ourselves in a subordinate position to men, and for the men, by cooperating with other men. I think we'll skip that. The power of consciousness, this topic, I want to park and discuss for tomorrow at the Sunday program, because it's a good topic for a general audience also, even for very new people. It's an interesting topic, how consciousness actually works. And what it actually is, and how it affects others around us, and so we'll keep that for tomorrow. Let us introduce the next one. Oh, you don't have that anymore. Now, yeah, quickly give the lesson 3 out. Okay, everybody has the materials. Actually, before we start with this session, let me add one more little thing to his question there, Puruji. Yes. Also, what you mentioned this morning, you know, that you sometimes devotee might feel so helpless and depressed and this and that. So feeling helpless is another very important quality of a Vaishnava, actually. The more we advance, the more actually we feel helplessly dependent on Krishna. Yes, that's another result of the false ego diminishing, that we feel helpless. Because what makes us feel so great and confident is actually, as a rule, the false ego. And once we get freed from the false ego, we realize how Maya is so strong and how tiny and insignificant we are, and how Maya can come at any time and carry us away. But there is two kinds of helplessness. There's material helplessness and there's spiritual helplessness. Material always means not connected with Krishna, whereas spiritual means connected with Krishna. So material helplessness means we still have ourselves in the center, and we just go in circles around ourselves. Oh, I'm so useless, I will never make it. Oh, I'm so, oh, incompetent. And it's all about I, right? And we just go in circles around ourselves. It's a kind of self-indulgence. We are cooking in our own soup there, you know, and just feel pity for ourselves and still I am in the center there. There's no connection to Krishna. So, and that kind of helplessness leads to depression and being suicidal and for giving up Krishna consciousness and I'm just never going to make it. That's a mundane helplessness. But spiritual helplessness means I'm helpless, I'm tiny, insignificant. Let me take shelter of Krishna and his devotees. And then we move Krishna in the center. And we take shelter of the process. And then that kind of helplessness is actually necessary for spiritual progress, because it leads to taking shelter. Right? So the point is the taking shelter has to be there. That's the goal of the helplessness. But if the helplessness doesn't lead to taking shelter of Krishna and his devotees and the process of devotional service, it's useless, it's mundane. Right? Yeah, so we have to understand the two different kinds of helplessness. We have to kick out this mundane kind of helplessness there where we just feel pity for ourselves or something. No, we have to take shelter tightly, you know? And also another thing I forgot to mention, that the false ego has these two effects, actually. For one effect, and we could say the more common effect, is that the ego makes us arrogant and super confident, overconfident and proud, and we think we can do it all and we're so great and all that. But then there is also another effect of the false ego, namely that we get all insecure and mental, and we have all minority complexes. This is also, interestingly, it's also an effect of the false ego. And it comes about because the ego actually wants, it's pushing for that satisfaction to be so fantastic, but then due to maybe our material abilities and karma, we can't be as fantastic as the ego wants us to be. So, and then as a result of that, we get all insecure and mental and have some complexes and. So that's also an effect of the false ego, actually. Yeah? Yeah, you understand what I'm talking about? Yes? Yes? Being feeling guilty.
Yeah.
Well, it depends. If it is a healthy sense of guilt, you know, that we feel, or we feel regretful, you know, that we did something wrong, you know, that if it is a healthy feeling of regret, that is wanted, that is necessary, that is purifying. But if we are hanging on to and we are drowning ourselves in guilt feelings, yeah, well, this is also, yeah, one can say, I mean, ultimately, it's all, everything is the false ego. Yes, but if we can't let go of things, you know, I mean, we get, probably tomorrow we get to this point of feeling, being offended, you know. So this is also an effect of the false ego, but we won't get there today. So let's park the guilt feeling. I dare say it fits into the category also of being offended. But let me just at least quickly introduce, we've got only a few minutes, but let me quickly introduce Not only is the false ego so near and dear to us that we are always protecting and defending it, but we also like to feed it. We like to feed it and blow it up and massage each other's egos because it is so near and dear to us. You know, that's why we like to feed it. Meaning, we like to look for opportunities to be recognized and glorified, where we get the credit. Yes, yes. And again, Krishna consciousness offers a lot of opportunities for that if we look for them, right? To somehow be the center and recognition and Facebook and all this kind of thing. Of course, we know we have some Facebook watchers, but Facebook also has some little good things, but so many negative aspects are also coming along there, you know. Yeah, so this is actually, again, there is the Vaishnav etiquette rule that actually a devotee should avoid situations where he is recognized, where he is glorified. He should not seek them, but he should actually avoid them because he doesn't want to feed his ego. Yes. But again, you know, we usually don't hear about these things. We are all going for it and we are eagerly accepting any kind of opportunity where we are glorified and recognized and we are standing in the center there and you know. Yes, yes. So that's why Vaishnav etiquette is there to try and help us to subdue the ego and dissolve it instead of feeding and blowing it up. Right? Actually, interestingly, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, when he was on this planet, he did not allow his disciples to put pictures of him in public. He was saying, this is not good for my false ego. While I'm on this planet, you cannot do this. When I'm gone, then you can put up pictures. But while I'm here, don't do it. Not good for my false ego. So now, of course, Bhaktisiddhanta was free from false ego, but why did he say that? To instruct us. You know, that just, for example, such a thing as having your picture in public, this is really feeding the ego like anything. And sometimes I'm wondering what Bhaktisiddhanta would say about Facebook, you know, where people so eagerly publish pictures of themselves. Oh my God. There's this whole vanity, you know. People are in love with themselves, you know. Oh, you know, and they're putting pictures on, oh, that's me doing this, that's me doing that, and the ladies all with open hair and this and that. And oh, my God, you know. And everybody sees my picture all over the world. And this immensely feeds the ego, like anything. Like anything. I completely stay away from this. I do have a Facebook page, but just for my Institute for Spiritual Culture, and I told them not to post pictures of me there, and you know, I keep it completely low profile, and somebody else is managing it for me. Just because people told me you have to have a Facebook page, and okay, you know, but I'm not into this. No, I'm not advanced enough. You know, I don't want to blow up my ego like this and feed it, and everybody sees me, and oh my God, you know, yeah. I mean, we don't even realize these subtle effects, you know. Yes, but if we're a little introspective, you know, we can detect how it actually does something to the ego, you know, to have your picture all over the world and everybody sees you and this and that, you know. Or the selfies, you know. Oh my God. Yes. People are so enamored into themselves and always taking pictures of themselves. And this is all, you know, it's all feeding the ego like anything. It's poisoning our spiritual practice, these things, you know. There is a very nice purport where Prabhupada makes this humorous statement. He says, in the material world, even an ass enjoys his own sound vibration. Ooh, 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 ooh. The ass thinks, my sound is so beautiful, everybody has to hear my sound. This is the mood in the material world. And then Prabhupada continues and says, but in the spiritual world, in the Vaikuntha planets, everybody wants to hear from the others. The beautiful birds like the chakravaka, the cuckoos, the peacocks, they rather want to hear the humming of the bees, how they glorify the Lord. That's the mood in the spiritual world. They're the you know, the residents don't consider their own sound so beautiful. You know, they rather want to hear from the others. Oh, how are they glorifying the Lord? Yeah, so, but in the material world, even the ass enjoys his own sound. I really like that because that's just so true. And let us be honest, you know, we all have a bit of this ass-like mentality. We all have a little ass there living in our heart who is trying to stick up his ugly head at any opportunity, making some big noise, wanting to bring attention to himself and be recognized and heard and. So just to subdue this ass, just not to give him any chance. That's why, again, there is Vaishnava etiquette in culture. Yes. For example, in regards to leading kirtans or even to in regards to speaking, one should only do these things when one is invited to do so. That's the etiquette. We should never be so eager, okay, let me sing now and let me lead and it's my turn and this is all the ass there at its work, you know, trying to be heard and noticed, thinking, oh, our sound is so beautiful, everybody has to hear it, and. So this is a really important rule of Vaishnava etiquette, that we should only sing and, you know, do anything, basically, or mainly sing and lead, even in regards to Tulsi Aarti in the mornings. I observed this in many temples, that nobody invites anybody, you know? And often it's like that, although, I mean, this morning I was invited to do the Tulsi Aarti. But even there, this is the etiquette. We should invite others. We should not just stand there. In some temples it's like that. Everybody stands there. Okay, whose turn is it? Nobody's taking off the socks. Okay, well, if I quickly take off my socks, then okay, it's my turn, obviously, because nobody else is doing it. Wrong mood. No, we are meant to invite others. Would you like to do the arti? You know? And it's not that only seniors can invite juniors. No, the juniors should also invite the seniors. Even the seniors should actually only lead and do these things when they're invited. Just to make sure, you know, it's not some ego thing behind it that, we want to be in the front there. You know? Yes. And this is very often it is neglected and not observed, you know? Even in a detail like the at Kartik time, singing the Damodarastika, right? I know some temples, they just say, on the notice board we have the list there and everybody can just put down their names whenever they want to lead the Damodarastika song. Really against etiquette. You know? Because that's exactly what we should not do, that everybody just runs to the list and puts down their name, you know, and the junior people, the bhaktas and bhaktins run first there. Okay, I'm putting down my name, I want to sing here and here and here. You know, and then the senior devotees, oh, well, there's no spot for them anymore, you know. Or something. No, this is wrong etiquette. It might be more saving time. But the proper etiquette is that somebody should go around and invite the senior people first. Oh, would you like to sing the Dhammadasika in the Kartik month? Okay, which evening are you free? Okay, what about that day? And would you like to sing there also? And. So we start with the senior devotees first. You know? And then when there's some free spots, then all right, the junior devotees can also have a spot there, you know. But it's not that everybody should just run and put down their names. You know, it's completely against Vaishnav culture and etiquette. You know, and these kind of things, they look maybe like little details, but they all have a reason. They have a purpose. They're meant to help us to give up our false egos. You know? And in one community, I don't want to mention the name, but somebody was telling me, you know, one Madhuji was on the list there to sing the Dhammadasika, and then one Marge came. And then some devotees suggested, oh, maybe Marge should be invited to lead. Oh, she was all angry. Oh, it's my day. How is this? It's my chance. It's my day. You know? My God, you know, where are we? You know? If then we compete there with a Marge or something, and I mean, oh, terrible, 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 you know, real ego thing, you know, yes. And I mean, especially in kirtans, I usually discuss these things in detail in the holy name retreats I like to conduct. But once we get on deeper understandings of chanting the holy name, we don't care anymore who leads, whether we lead or somebody else leads. That all loses its significance when we understand what kirtan is all about. That kirtan is all about connecting with the Lord. That's what kirtan is all about. You know? And if we feel only satisfaction when we lead, oh, well, where is our satisfaction coming from? Definitely not from the holy name, right? If it was coming from the holy name, we wouldn't care less who leads, whether we lead or we sing along. You know, if the satisfaction comes from chanting the holy name, it will be there. But if we are only satisfied when we lead, then obviously we are running after ego satisfaction. Let's be honest, let's be clear here. That's not the satisfaction coming from the holy name. No, we are running after some ego gratification. Yes. Anyway, it's a big topic. But yes, as a devotee, we should avoid, you know, feeding our egos. We should avoid these opportunities where we are recognized, glorified, and actually, the Vaishnav mood is Vaishnava feels uncomfortable when he's glorified. He's blocking his ears, running away. He doesn't want to hear it. You know, but what are we doing? Oh, we are lapping it up. Oh, finally somebody realizes my greatness. Okay. We like to hear our glories chanted, you know. Yes. Yes, but the etiquette is a different one, you know. We are meant to avoid, you know. And the story again, Chaitanya Charitamrita with Madhavendra Puri, you know, when he got that bow of sweet rice there from the Lord was hiding it. So he's running off. Oh, if everybody hears that, then they will all glorify me. So he's leaving the village, you know. He doesn't want to hear it. Or he doesn't want to be in that situation where his glories get spread. And so that's the Vaishnav mood, you know. Anyway, I think we'll leave it at that for the time being because we have already gone over time a little bit. So tomorrow morning, 8 to 9, we will continue. So please be back tomorrow at 8 o'clock. Before you all shovel with your papers, is there any last question on this? I mean, we've only introduced the topic. We will continue tomorrow. But before you go, please do me one more favor. Just quickly turn to your neighbor and share what did you get out of this session? What is the realization of this evening session for you? What are you taking home? Quickly, share something. Hopefully something. Okay, Guru Premanande, Hari Hari Bol. Last little reminder, we still got these books here, so I highly recommend you to get a copy of it. It will give you deepest insights into the topics. Thank you very much. To be continued tomorrow, 8 o'clock. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samavita Bhaktivinoda ki, Guru Premanande, Hare Krishna.